Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Yes or no, in or out, stay or go. You could flip a coin on the Scottish referendum. The question is which coin? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Risnall. It is Tuesday, today the 16th of September. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. There is, if you really stop to think about it, no bigger macroeconomic story this week than the Scottish vote on independence. Yes, the Federal Reserve is meeting, and yes, the Dow is at a record high. But come Thursday, it'll be yay or nay on whether Scotland stays or goes, quite possibly ending 300 years of political and very substantial economic ties with the rest of the UK. Of the many, many economic questions posed by this referendum, the most basic is probably this. What kind of money are they going to use? From Glasgow, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
This coffee shop is one small battleground in the referendum campaign. Customers can buy a cupcake which shows which way they're going to vote.
Can I get two no and one undecided, please?
21-year-old James Rogerson is ordering for a friend one undecided cake, decorated with a question mark, and two no cakes bearing the flag of the United Kingdom for himself.
I just feel that we're better together, and I just don't think our government's strong enough to cope on its own.
Many Scots feel the same. Opinion polls and cake sales in this shop show that some 50% will vote no to independence. One of their biggest concerns, the Scottish Government's currency plan, which many say just doesn't add up.
It just doesn't make sense.
Ken Simon, the leading light here at the No Campaign HQ, he's baffled that the Nationalists want to break away from the UK but carry on using the British pound.
They say they're about independence. I have real questions about whether that amounts to independence. They would keep the Bank of England with the governor of the Bank of England appointed by the UK government. It just doesn't make sense.
We're actually lining their own pockets! I charge Jim Murphy!
On the streets of Glasgow, the fiery rhetoric of independence is all about throwing off the 300-year-old shackles of English rule. But quietly, behind the scenes, Professor Mike Danson, a Yes campaign economics expert, says that should not include ditching the pound.
It benefits both Scotland and the rest of the UK to retain sterling, to retain the pound.
After all, he says, the rest of the UK is Scotland's biggest import and export market. It's worth $180 billion a year. It wouldn't make sense for the rest of the UK to insist on Scotland having a separate currency.
Why would they increase costs for their own businesses to be able to sell into Scotland?
But all three main political parties in the UK say an independent Scotland couldn't have the pound. Isn't that a major obstacle?
In some ways, it's not theirs to say whether we can have it or not. It's a shared asset. It's as much Scotland's pound as it is England or Wales's pound and so forth.
While you remain within the United Kingdom.
Or even beyond. It's an asset up for negotiations.
And he says Scotland's got the whip hand. If the rest of the UK refuses to share the pound, then the newly independent country will walk away from its share of the UK's national debt. Pro-independence businessman Ivan McKee says he's sure the UK would see sense.
Not least because they won't want to spook the international money markets, who would be very worried if there wasn't certainty around the currency arrangements for Scotland and the rest of the UK going forward.
The money markets have already been spooked. Last week's surge in support for the Yes campaign triggered a big sell-off in the British currency. But Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman from the US still says the UK would be mad to let an independent Scotland keep the pound.
Look at what has happened in Europe. We have an unprecedented experiment in sharing a currency without being part of the same country. And it's a disaster. The euro area is doing worse this time around than it did in the 1930s.
All such warnings have received the same response from the Nationalists. Bagpipe enthusiast Debbie Hughes limbering up with Scotland the Brave. She's voting yes on Thursday, dismissing what she calls the scare stories, confident that an independent Scotland will be a huge economic success.
What about the currency, though? It does look as if you're not going to get the pound.
Well, no, I do not believe that. I think the pound is as much ours as it is England's.
Like many young Scots, she finds the prospect of independence exhilarating. But unless the critical question of currency is properly handled, a vote for independence could bring turmoil to Scotland and the rest of the UK. In Glasgow, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today in the New World, as it were, no turmoil at all, not even a wee bit. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This is a big month for TV. A lot of shows are coming back from their summer hiatus, hoping last spring's cliffhangers were enough to get you tuning in again. That's a simple enough proposition, but it's about the only thing that's easy about the business of television today, where what we watch and how we watch it is changing and fast. We're going to spend some time on those changes over the next couple of weeks in our series, Screen Wars.
Television. No money down.
That one's in the dirt.
On a brighter note, commercial break.
There was a time when premium cable companies like Showtime and HBO were the new thing in TV. You just write a monthly check and, hey, no commercials. Well, that was then. This is now. So how is a network executive supposed to keep up? David Nevins is the president of Showtime, so it is kind of his job to think about all that. David Nevins, welcome to the program.
Kai Ryssdal, it's good to be here. I'm such a longtime fan. I'm excited.
Well, I appreciate that. That's very kind. Especially coming from a TV guy. You have been in TV for a zillion years. You spent a lot of time in the broadcast networks, at NBC specifically. Mm-hmm. And what I want to bring up with you just as we get going is the shift that's happening now from the broadcast networks to premium channels like Showtime and some other outlets. How do you account for that?
There's so many people making so much television now. And the lucky thing for me is that when I was in the network world, I was always making the shows that were pushing the limits of the medium, sometimes struggling to stay on the air, shows like Friday Night Lights and Arrested mm-hmm. Development. And now in the premium world, you get rewarded for shows like that.
We were talking about those two shows before you came in the room, and somebody mentioned that really they were premium cable shows that somehow appeared on network TV.
Right.
How
and they struggled
happen?
On network
yeah,
television.
They did. So what was the misfire?
Because they're a little bit more niche than is necessary to succeed in the broadcast world. And they were addictive. And now that passion and that dedication, I think, is more monetizable in a subscription service, whether it's Netflix or Showtime Anytime or HBO Go.
Do you ever think that the subscription model that you guys have, people writing checks every month to mm-hmm. get your content, do you ever think that that's a burden in that you have to then satisfy everybody who's writing you a check?
Well, I think you don't need to satisfy everybody with every show or everybody all the time. That's why you want to remain balanced gender-wise if you're in pay cable, because you don't want either half of the household, either a male half or female half, saying like, honey, why are we writing that check every month? You want to give value on to both. But I think if you've got two or three shows that people really like, that they're really into, that they're going to wait for next year, they're probably not going to let their subscription lapse.
There was broadcast TV, and then cable shook that up, and then premium cable shook that up. What's the next thing that's going to shake up television as we know it? I mean, what keeps you up at night?
What keeps me up is I want to make sure that we make the transitions to all the ways that people want to be able to consume us. We make it in the right way at the right time. And then the other thing which I'll say is that progression of new businesses from network TV to cable TV to premium cable TV to now all the online companies that are making content, they haven't really made their predecessors go extinct. Broadcast television is still a very profitable business. Basic cable, still very profitable. So premium television is available to people on their iPads and on their phones and projected onto their eyeballs to the extent that Google Glass works that way.
Of all the things that television has to worry about in the next 25 years, how highly do you rank how we're going to pay for this? Right? I mean, you've got a good model, but not everybody does. And this is a big business. So where's that whole revenue calculation in the industry?
Demand is there. There's no question demand is there. I don't see demand going anywhere. The challenge, the how do we get paid for it challenge comes out of the captive audience sitting has to watch the 30-second ad. That's where some of the challenges are, and there's other ways that people are demanding to see it, some of which aren't so conducive to the 30-second ad. So, but I think people are rapidly figuring it out, and I think as long as demand for television doesn't go away, we'll figure out the business model challenges.
What's the show that you had a chance at that you didn't grab that now you go, oh, God?
Well, I wanted, and I thought I was buying True Detective, but got taken away at the last second.
Care to tell the story?
It's still too raw.
Too soon?
Too soon.
David Nevins, the president of Showtime, they're lamenting the one that got away. We've got more from our series Screen Wars online at marketplace.org. David Nevins and I were talking about the subscription model of television revenue generation just there, which is one way to go. The other is more traditional, I guess you could say, advertising. Ad spending on the broadcast networks, though, was off more than 7% in the second quarter. Some of that money is going to online ads, but as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains, it is way too early to count old-fashioned TV out just yet.
It is true that digital video advertising is ballooning this year, and it is true that TV as a whole is just sort of plodding along. However,
digital video is growing, but very little is really, at this point, coming at the expense of broadcast and cable.
David Hallerman is principal analyst at eMarketer. He says digital video advertising revenue is still feeding on the decaying carcass of print and radio. Reports of TV's advertising demise are vastly exaggerated.
You're dealing with two industries, digital and advertising, that are the most hyperbole-prone industries in the world.
The real battle is, for now, still between network TV and cable TV. Eric Brannon is senior analyst with IHS Technology.
Broadcast television has been suffering at the hands of cable in recent years, and that's because cable has been more effective in competing for first-run series.
As in, the shows have been really good on cable. John Swallen is chief research officer of Kantar Media. He says networks from both sides have been clawing over advertising eyeballs.
So far this year, I mean, broadcast networks, the feather in their cap was the Winter Olympics for the cable networks. The big sporting events have been World Cup, as well as the March Madness for the NCAA men's basketball tournament.
For network TV, a lot of advertisers spent big money on the Olympics and didn't have much left over for the second quarter, making it look kind of bad. So for now, cable looks like it's winning. Still, the outlook for network TV ad revenue this year is about 3-5% growth. Not great, but not doomed either. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Now, a fix for climate change that won't cost a thing. All right, so that's one interpretation of a report published today in the run-up to next week's big United Nations Climate Summit by a group called the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate. There is, don't you know, lots of fine print, though. The freebie math only works on the global economy level, balancing costs and benefits before you look at who pays the cost and who gets the benefits. Marketplace's Dan Weissman takes a closer look.
The Global Commission's report projects that one way or the other, the world will spend around $90 trillion on infrastructure in the next 15 years.
And our argument is that it would be smart to invest the $90 trillion in a good way.
That's Jeremy Oppenheim. He's director of the Commission's New Climate Economy Project. He means things like transit for well-planned cities instead of highways to sprawling suburbs. He says the real message isn't that fighting climate change is free, but it doesn't get in the way of economic growth.
So those people that claim that these two goals are in conflict, they just don't have the evidence on their side.
That argument addresses a pointed question that developing countries often ask about climate change efforts. That's what Trevor Hauser of the Rhodium Group says. That question, How about us?
The West got rich following a very specific economic pathway,
which generated a lot of pollution.
And that in a carbon-constrained world, that pathway will not be available to developing countries.
This report suggests another path. However, there will be losers. Countries spend about $600 billion a year subsidizing fossil fuels. Somebody will miss that if it goes away. David Victor is an international relations professor at the University of California at San Diego and author of Global Warming Gridlock.
People who are going to lose from costly climate policy know who they are and are therefore raising concerns about that. And the winners, many of them don't exist.
Just like wind and solar barely existed not so long ago. I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
How I live right now is pretty month to month, and I'm fine. I'm not ever, you know, struggling, or I always make my rent, but I don't have savings. I don't have a retirement.
Life as a millennial. But first, let's do the numbers. All righty, here you go. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up 100 points, 0.6%, closed at 17,131. The NASDAQ advanced 33 points, 0.75%, 45.52. The S&P 500 gained 14 points, 0.75%, ended things at 1,998. Atlantic Power dropped 33% today, 33%, after saying it would replace its CEO and cut its dividend. Another big dipper was Majesco Entertainment. The video game maker shot down almost 20% today on larger-than-expected third-quarter losses, which were announced yesterday. Tough times continue for Sears. The department store owner lost 9%, and it's taking out a short-term loan from a hedge fund run by its CEO. Repeat after me. What could possibly go wrong? You are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index for August. The Senate Judiciary Committee holds a hearing on net neutrality. And it's the 50th anniversary of the premiere of TV supernatural Bewitched. Imagine cleaning the house, making dinner, and updating your Facebook status with a twitch of your nose. Ah, I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. From the pages of the Wall Street Journal today, this tidbit. Companies are buying back their own stock at a rate not seen since 2007. Dan Strumpf wrote the story. Dan, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I guess the most basic question is, why are all these companies buying back all this stock right now?
Well, the short answer is that they have lots and lots of money to do it with. Cash levels at public companies is at its highest level in years, well over $1 trillion in total in the S&P 500. Huh. And companies are under pressure, have been under pressure for a while to put that money to work. I mean, there's a number of things that companies can do with their cash. They can invest it in their business and grow the business later, or they can do sort of short-term and easier things like issue dividends. They can buy back stock. And what you've seen happen is a lot of companies are going with those latter two routes, particularly buybacks.
And this, we should say, is all happening at a time when volume in the market, that is the number of shares traded, is really, really low, relatively speaking.
That's right. Stock market volume has totally slumped this year. And there's actually quite a bit of debate in the marketplace as to why that's happening. A lot of people talk about sort of a lack of conviction in this market. I mean, we have this sort of slow but steadily growing economy, really no fireworks to speak of.
Yeah.
You've got a very supportive Federal Reserve that is sort of keeping things humming. But you're not seeing table pounding and sort of high conviction investing, despite the fact that the market is at all-time highs are pretty
close. At record
highs,
yeah. No, exactly.
Right.
Does it actually boost a company's stock price when it buys its own stock back? Does it work?
Yeah. I mean, there is a lot of evidence to suggest that it does work. The companies that do buy back their stock and have regular routine buyback programs do tend to outperform in the market. But there's no guarantee, of course. And at the end of the day, you know, most investors will tell you that what they want to see are companies with strong earnings, good balance sheets, growing revenue, things like that.
The big kahuna here going away is Apple. $32.9 billion in the past year of buying back its own stock. That's a whole lot of cash.
Apple's an interesting example because they resisted for so long buying back their stock. Because one of the criticisms that some investors level at companies that buy back a lot of stock is that, well, why can't you come up with anything else to do with that money? You know, it goes to the point that buying back stock is easy and investors like it, but you're essentially giving away your money as opposed to putting it to work. So a number of shareholders push the company to put that cash to work. And as a result, they relented a few years ago and now just plow that money into the market.
Dan Strumpf at The Wall Street Journal. Dan, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
In case you missed it, yesterday was the sixth anniversary of Lehman Brothers going under, which is, depending on how you look at it, a long time or no time at all. Mark us in the no time at all category, because even though the economy is mostly on the mend, lots of people are still feeling the after effects of the Great Recession, young adults in particular. Americans between the ages of 16 and 34 still have higher unemployment rates than that age group did before the crash, and they are missing out in so many other ways as well. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that story.
So one of the areas that people really enjoy in our houses are the master suites and the master bathrooms. Double shower heads.
Here's some place you're not likely to find too many 20 to early 30-somethings. It's a starter home for sale in a subdivision outside a mid-sized western city. Not too many young people are considering first-time home buying right now.
Yeah, then moving on upstairs into more of our living quarters of the house.
Nor are they achieving other traditional milestones of adulthood, says Paul Taylor at the Pew Research Center, like getting a career track job, buying a car, getting married, having children.
Every one of those milestones is happening later in life for this generation of young adults.
Taylor says compared to their parents and grandparents, today's young adults are less mobile. They tend to stay put. They live with roommates or with mom and dad more, too. It's often described as a generation that has failed to launch, but Taylor says parents and millennials themselves don't necessarily see it that way.
Look, if there ain't any jobs out there, hanging out, you know, with mom and dad is not a bad deal. The refrigerator is usually stocked, and you don't have to put coins in the washing machine. And the generations actually get along pretty well.
So what are young people doing to launch themselves as independent, self-supporting adults in this difficult economy? Lucas Cook is playing the congas, pursuing his art. I met him one Sunday morning in downtown Portland, Oregon. He's in his early 20s, grew up in the suburbs, went to a local college, and kept living with his parents after he graduated. Now he's living with friends in what he calls
music and meditation pad. It's super nice. Feels like a new level of freedom.
What was it like to live at home?
Super intense. My parents have very different ideals than I do, and so it's kind of a process of coming away from them ideologically while still being in their house, and that was really stressful.
Cook is making some money playing gigs, which is partly how he's able to move out on his own.
I would love a cup of coffee, please.
Justine Pope grabs a drink at a cafe in downtown Portland. She's 28 and is only now moving out on her own after living with roommates. Pope went to an elite college and has held down three or four jobs right through the recession. Law firm assistant, yoga teacher, gardener. She does feel she's making material progress. She's about to start a master's program in public health, but she's also kind of despairing of her material progress.
How I live right now is pretty month to month, and I'm fine. I'm not ever, you know, struggling or I always make my rent, but I'm not increasing from there. I don't have savings. I don't have a retirement.
How about buying a home?
Unimaginable to me. When my mom was my age, she had had her first kid. They were on their way to buying a home. And I feel the life that I'm living now, while very happy, is not setting me up for a comfortable middle-aged lifestyle. I really hope to be a stable middle-aged person.
Bill Emmons, an economist at the St. Louis Fed, thinks most people Pope's age will catch up eventually.
Life expectancies keep rising, and by the time millennials reach their 50s and 60s, they may well be looking at another 10 or 15 years of work. Maybe everything could be extended. You know, there are some limits on that, like childbearing can't be delayed forever, but buying a house can.
But other scholars think the pattern of young people not making these traditional life cycle moves could be long-lasting.
Maybe millennials aren't living with parents and roommates, pursuing their art and dreams instead of chasing high-powered lucrative careers because of the bad economy alone. Maybe the culture's changing, and this is the way many of these young people will still be when they hit middle age. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, what may turn out to be an uh-oh moment for the National Football League amid its current difficulties. Anheuser-Busch, which is in the middle of a six-year, $1.2 billion sponsorship deal with the league, issued a statement today, short and sweet, from the brewer. "We are disappointed and increasingly concerned by the recent incidents that have overshadowed this NFL season. We are not yet satisfied with the league's handling of behaviors." It goes on, "We have shared our concerns and expectations with the league." So there you go. And with that, we are out of here. The Dow up 100 points today. The century mark 0.6%. The NASDAQ advanced 33 points, 0.75%. The S&P 500 picked up 14 points, 0.75% there as well. Our special projects team is Nancy Fargali and Millie Jefferson. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Esch are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin, Shay Huffman, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.